This is The Sweeper, the proper pan-European football podcast where we cover absolutely all of the lovable leagues from across the continent. The Sweeper is hosted by Tom Midler and Lee Wingate, and it's brought to you by FotMob.
In this bonus episode of The Sweeper, we're speaking to Matt Walker, the author of Europe United, about his mission to watch a football match in all 55 UEFA countries within one season. Hello, hello, dear listener, and welcome to this bonus episode of The Sweeper. I'm Lee Wingate, your host for today. Now, those of you who have listened to our very first episode or even followed us on social media will know that our remit is very much to spread the love to all 55 UEFA countries. So just imagine our excitement when we found out about Matt Walker, a man who had made it his mission to watch a top-flight football match in every one of those countries in just one season, and then wrote a book about his whole experience called Europe United. Well, we swiftly wrote to Matt asking to interview him, and we can happily say that this podcast is the first in a longer series about his continental travels. In this episode, we look at the first five countries he visited: Georgia, Iceland, the Faroe Islands, Norway, and Sweden.
The Sweeper is brought to you by FotMob, the essential app for football fans. Get live scores, tables, detailed stats, breaking news, and much more for more than 350 competitions from around the world. And what's more, FotMob's recently introduced a whole range of new features, including live XG data for selected tournaments and leagues. So if you're a casual football fan, a stats nut, or somewhere in between, FotMob is the perfect app for you, and it's free. Download it on Android and iOS now by searching for FotMob. That's FOTMOB.
Matt, thanks so much for joining us on the Sweeper podcast today, and congratulations on the launch of the paperback version of your book, Europe United. We've already outlined the focus of the book in our intro, but perhaps we can hear it in your own words too. What is Europe United about?
Thanks very much for inviting me on the podcast. Europe United is about football and travel. It's the combination of the two. It's one man, one normal football fan's exploration of Europe's 55 top divisions.
You've mentioned in the opening pages of the book that you've travelled quite extensively. You say you've been to over 80 countries. You've watched football in Borneo, Mexico, Iran, Colombia. There's obviously a big difference between watching one isolated game overseas and packing 55 into 1 year. How did you come up with the idea for the challenge, and what were the rules that you set for yourself?
As you've implied, I've done quite a lot of travelling even before this adventure. And I think I really wanted to push myself and not just travel for the sake of travel, but to travel for a particular reason, in this case, to cover the 55 UEFA nations in one season. And it was that one season that really, really appealed. I realised that nobody had ever completed this challenge before or written a book about it. And it would give me almost transparency by travelling and watching football through all of these countries at roughly the same time. And as for the rules, well, my rules were that it has to be the 2017-18 season. I had to watch a top division match in full in all of the 55 UEFA nations. And I also threw in a curious rule as well. I had to try and have a local beer in each of the 55 UEFA nations as well.
That last rule sounds like an absolute winner to me. Did you have a favourite beer from your 55 nations?
I think Latvian beer was some of the best that I tried, actually, because they used really curious ingredients from the Baltic nation. So yeah, I enjoyed the beer there. I enjoyed it probably more so than some of the mainstream countries.
Excellent. Good to know. We'll bear that in mind for our trip to Riga then. When you were formulating the idea, you considered various geographical regions around the world. In the book you wrote, and this made me laugh, I considered the immense African confederation of 56 countries for precisely 1 minute. So after full consideration, why did you settle on Europe and perhaps not somewhere else?
It's a good question. I mean, as you say, I did consider the other confederations before settling on UEFA. I mean, I think UEFA's got the real diversity of sort of some of the behemoths of football, like Germany and Spain, and then some really, really understated countries that people don't know very much about, like Armenia and some of the microstates like Andorra. And it was that diversity that I'd be watching some of the very best football leagues in the world, and some leagues where I knew there would be very few people attending, where, you know, they were part-time and it would be free entrance. And I think that diversity really, really appealed as well. But as you mentioned in one of your earlier questions, I had traveled a lot in other continents. And actually, when I left an earlier job, I got given a Lonely Planet to Western Europe, because the implication was that I'd never traveled very much in my own continent. It wasn't quite true, but I certainly thought it would be there and ripe for exploration. And it certainly proved to be the case.
To make this trip happen, you took a year-long break from work from your job at the Ministry of Justice. You mentioned in the book briefly about conversations with some of your colleagues, but I'm interested to know how generally your friends, family, work colleagues reacted when you told them about this, because on the face of it, it does sound like rather a crazy idea.
I don't think they were that surprised, actually. I think, you know, they knew about my twin loves of football and travel, and they probably knew that I was sort of building up to something like this. I think they were actually more surprised that I decided to join social media for the first time to help me on my travels and to promote them. And I had lots of curious messages on Facebook, which I had never joined until 2017, saying, "Matt, where have you been for the last 20 years? Those sort of things.
We're going to speak about the very first leg of your journey today, which took you to the following five countries in the following order: Georgia, Iceland, the Faroe Islands, Norway, and Sweden. I'm sure our listeners will agree that Iceland to Sweden sounds like a very logical journey. Why did you start in Tbilisi only to go, you know, 5,000 kilometers back in the other direction to Iceland?
Yeah, I got a bit of a curveball just before I started my travels, in that Georgia, I found, switched from kind of the conventional autumn leagues to a summer league. And I realized that I had my schedule penned out. It was more like penciled out, because I had to change quite a few of the orders of the countries that I visited. And I realized I had to squeeze them in before my more logical sweep across the Nordic countries. And then actually, when I got to Georgia, I found that the game I was going to see, it was actually in a different city and a different stadium than I was intending to visit. So actually, my first country, my first stadium, and my first city had all changed from my original plans. And I was really kind of hopeful that wasn't going to happen in all of the other 54 countries that I visited.
You mentioned in the book that on your first day in Georgia, you met up with the vice president of the Georgian Football Federation. And in fact, I think you said that he was the one that confirmed the kickoff time for you. How easy was it to get access to contacts like that throughout your trip? Because I presume that heavily depended on the country in question.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, you know, there is a kind of very good network of football people who try and help one another. And that's both from the sort of traveling capacity and also those that actually work in the clubs. So I found that clubs were generally very helpful when I contacted them, asking them about, you know, whether their fixtures were going to change or not. Indeed, in Kosovo, I think a rival club actually let me know that their entire fixture list was going to change before I travelled there. But it was a lot harder in the predominantly Russian-speaking countries in the Far East of Europe. I did send lots of messages to clubs in the likes of Russia and Belarus and didn't get a single response.
Could be down to the challenge of language, perhaps, which I guess you mentioned the diversity of Europe earlier. There are so many different languages. You know, it's not like South America where you'd be predominantly fine with Spanish. I presume that language was quite a challenge for you throughout this trip.
Yeah, I didn't think it was one of the hardest challenges, because English is so widespoken across Europe. You can, even in the likes of sort of Belarus and Moldova, I still found people who were able to speak English with me. I think it was perhaps a little bit more difficult in the likes of Kazakhstan and Russia. So yeah, I think the fact that I'm an English speaker really helped. But yeah, there were a large number of languages spoken by the 55 countries that I visited, and that was one of the appeals, actually, because of the varieties of culture that I got to explore.
What about your first game then in Georgia? You chose De La Gori versus Lokomotiv Tbilisi. probably two teams that most of our listeners have never heard of. I certainly hadn't. What was the thinking behind that, and what was the game like itself?
I guess I wanted to pick a fixture that was close to Tbilisi because that was the capital I was gonna fly into. But as I mentioned earlier, this was Dilagori. Gori's about 50 kilometers away from Tbilisi. They were due to be the home team, but it actually got switched because their stadium was being renovated at the time. So I actually went to the Mikhail Meshki Stadium, which is one of the big stadiums in Tbilisi, to watch the match. And I think this was a kind of a theme throughout of the countries that I visited, was that, you know, when you're traveling so much anyhow to get around 55 UEFA nations in one season, you didn't want to take too many kind of additional unnecessary trips just to clock up a game in an obscure city that was quite hard to reach.
You mentioned the name of the stadium there, the Mikhail Meshki Stadium. I think you had a chance meeting with that man's grandson, didn't you? Perhaps you can tell us a little bit about that, because that was one of my favourite parts of the opening chapter.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was an incredible coincidence. I was just wandering around central Tbilisi trying free samples of wine in the many wine shops around the capital, and just found out that the person who owned this particular wine shop was, as you said, Mikhail Meshki, who's Georgia's probably best known player, certainly in Georgia itself, his grandson. And indeed, he was a player in his youth before injury curtailed that, and he ended up, you know, running this wine shop. And it was one of those moments that really made that first country, as you said, because we went up into the hills overlooking the town and had a fine meal, and it's actually I think it really sort of gave me a buzz in that very first weekend in Georgia.
I think it's that football being a thing that brings absolutely everybody together. And, you know, from the way you described that, it seemed like as soon as you mentioned what you were doing, and the same for the vice president at the Georgian Football Federation, that their eyes more or less lit up. Did you find during your trip that, you know, as soon as people found out what you were doing, they were really interested?
I think most people were really interested. But you know, I think the thing with football is that it's so ubiquitous that everyone has a reaction to it. So, I mean, if you're a fan, obviously you can be sidetracked and talk about the game for hours. But even if you're not a fan, you still have a reaction to the fact that other people are fans. And I think that was one of the sort of the common threads when I traveled across Europe. But yes, generally a lot of people were really interested in my story. It helped me get quite a lot of coverage and contacts, and helped sort of build links with clubs and nations that may not have been possible if I was just visiting, you know, sort of a random game on a holiday.
Talking of coverage, you mentioned that The Guardian did a feature article on you, your travels and you know, your whole plan to see a game in 55 European countries. Did that give your trip some kind of legitimacy? Were you able to use that to kind of prove what you were doing and perhaps make some contacts that you might not have otherwise been able to have?
I think that's very much the case. I mean, that Guardian article got replicated all across the world. It ended up in Brazil, in Hong Kong, in various local newspapers who basically just translate it into the local language and then claim the credit for themselves. But actually, it was beneficial in a number of different ways. It did give me some sort of backing that enabled me to get in touch with clubs and then say, well, you know, I've been featured in The Guardian, and a lot of them would have read the article and be aware of it. But it also, even people who weren't aware of the challenge or really into football, it helped in those circumstances as well. So I carried a printout of that article around with me, and it actually helped me get into Azerbaijan, because the border officials at Baku Airport were very skeptical about my trip. But I actually provided them you know, sort of evidence that I was visiting the country to watch a football match as part of my challenge, which was an unexpected use of a Guardian article.
Yeah, it sounds like that the printout version of that article was arguably more important than your passport then, as your number one document to carry around.
It felt like that at times. I obviously, you know, flashed it on my phone a couple of times, and I think it was in later on in my trip where I managed to get an unemployed person's discount in Belfast by flashing them evidence that I was not working because I was traveling around Europe watching football, which was, I thought that was pushing it a little bit, but
You've got to push the boundaries sometimes. I think, you know,
exactly.
You know, if you don't ask, you don't get. So good on you for trying. After Georgia, you were in Iceland, so a big trip in the other direction. You had one league game that you planned to go to as your kind of allotted game, your game in Iceland, but then you had an opportunity to go to what I presume was the other game the night before. Is that right?
That's right. So Stjarnan was my allotted game and Breidablik was my bonus game. Yeah.
So was this kind of a theme throughout your trip, you know, that although you had to see at least one top flight game in each country, essentially you'd go to whatever matches time and money permitted, or was Iceland a bit of an exception in this case?
I think, yeah, I don't think Iceland was an exception. I did end up seeing, you know, sort of quite a number of games in different countries. But, you know, as I mentioned earlier, there was a lot of travel already. So I wasn't going to sort of travel 6 or 7 hours just for the sake of seeing another game. But if it happened to be in the local area, and that was very much the case in Iceland, where the two games were on successive nights and they were only a couple of miles apart. So, you know, I was interested to see what would happen at all of these matches. So yeah, I obviously took in the bonus game the night before.
Nice. Lots of people know about the Icelandic national team, of course, due to their, you know, exploits over the last half a decade or so. But what about the domestic league? Because I think that that's something that not too many people will know about. What's domestic football like in Iceland?
It's a curious affair, really. It's a very well-supported league, the Icelandic league. And that might not come through when you see the attendances, which I think of the two games I saw, I think one was about 1,000, one was more like 2,000. You have to remember there's only 300,000 people in Iceland in totality. So as a proportion of the population, they get quite a large number going to their games. And because of that, it's a real family atmosphere. There isn't really much rivalry between the clubs. So people bring their other halves along, they bring their grandmother along, they bring their kids along, and often they'll have, you know, sort of a picnic in the grassy area next to the stadium. And that was almost unique in all of the 55 UEFA nations I visited, because a real family feel. But the style of football was a bit of an English throwback. I think I mentioned that in the book. There was lots of kind of long diagonal balls played towards the lofty striker, which was kind of like watching English football sort of a few decades ago.
The start of your trip was kind of a little bit like island hopping, wasn't it? Because you were first in Iceland and then you were off to the Faroe Islands. And I have to admit, this is one of my favourite bits that I read in the opening chapters of your book, because there were only two flights per week from Iceland to the Faroe Islands. And you turned up at the wrong airport before your flight with only 1 hour to go. Tell us about that and how much of a panic were you in?
That's probably one of the 10 most stressful moments of my entire life, because I realised, you know, I was an hour's car journey away from the airport where I needed to get to be able to get to the Faroes. And I knew that this, if I missed this flight, it would cost me an enormous amount of money and potentially put the entire trip in jeopardy, because it would have a knock-on effect on the countries that I visited afterwards. So, yeah, it was an expensive taxi ride to make sure that I made that flight at the city airport in Reykjavik. But it was worth it, given how much it would have cost if I'd missed that plane.
Yeah, and you were on such a tight time schedule as well that I presume that 3 days extra in Iceland would have had an enormous knock-on effect throughout the rest of your plans for the coming weeks. So it must have been a huge sense of relief just from an organizational perspective that you managed to make that flight.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think my cover option would have had to have flown from Iceland to Norway to pick up my game in the fourth country that I visited. And then I would have had to come back to the Faroes in the sort of peak summer season in August, when I would have had to, you know, sort of pay a lot of money for an air ticket. So, yeah, I was so relieved to make that plane.
Your game in the Faroe Islands was HB versus Skala. You'd got caught in what you described as horizontal rain on the way to the stadium, and you were drenched within seconds. Were there any parts of this trip where it felt a little bit more like a slog, like something you'd committed to rather than, you know, the fairy tale adventure it might have seemed like to begin with?
Yeah, I think there were a few moments. I mean, you know, there was times when it took me 3 days to get from one city to the next, and I had to travel on, you know, sort of cramped and hot buses. And you're thinking, this isn't the dream. It'd be a lot easier if I was in an air conditioned office back in London. I am a lover of warm weather. So I always thought that the Nordic countries, even in the summer months, and then, you know, sort of going to the likes of Austria and Switzerland in the depths of March, were going to be some of the most challenging moments on the trip. And I certainly felt, you know, I was a little bit under the weather, should we say, as I walked towards the stadium in the Faroe Islands.
What was that game like?
I mean, the style of football was quite similar to Iceland, I would say. You know, again, you know, quite a lot of long balls being played towards the striker, but it was noticeably a lower level, I found, than the Icelandic league.
One of our followers on Twitter, Luxembourg Footy, asks, did you visit anything else other than the stadiums, especially in Iceland and the Faroe Islands, or was it more like a speed run?
I mean, I had an average of about 4 days in each country, and you know that varied from like 1 day in some places to 11 or 12 days, I think was the most I spent in any country. So I was able to take in some of the local sites as well. So I had about 4 days in Iceland and three in the Faroe. So, you know, I was able to visit some of the fantastic waterfalls and geysers in Iceland. And when in the Faroes, I took a boat trip and saw the dramatic Vestmanna bird cliffs, which are incredible. They're hundreds of meters high and they crash into the North Sea. So I was able to get a feel for the country as well as see the football. And I think that comes through in the book. And I think that was really important to get that balance of being aware of the wider country as well as the football scene.
I'm hoping myself to go to the Faroe Islands in October because Austria are playing against the Faroe Islands. And I'm absolutely, I think, mesmerised just by the look, and I'm intrigued by the layout with all the different islands dotted around. Is it a case that they're all connected by road, or do you really need a boat to get to each of the individual islands?
Actually, most of them are connected by a very elaborate network of tunnels, which go between the islands. And there are some of the outlying ones that you need to take a boat to get to. Unfortunately for me, the cost of car hire was far too high in the Faroe Islands for me to afford it on my budget. So I was only able to use the rather rudimentary bus system, which meant that I was hanging around at bus stops quite a bit. But that was part of the challenge. I couldn't just, you know, spend thousands of pounds in each country that I visited.
Absolutely. Your fourth and fifth countries were Norway and Sweden, and your choice of games was Brann versus Stabuk, I think, in Norway, and Häcken versus IFK Göteborg in Sweden. Why did you choose those two, and what were they like?
The Brann-Bergen game was quite a natural one because I could fly directly from Tórshavn, the capital of the Faroes, to Bergen. And just by chance, the game got moved to a Monday night in Norway. So I was able to fly on the Monday and then watch the game that evening, which was an incredible coincidence because it could either have been on Saturday or the Sunday. So some of it came down to logistics. I mean, if Brann hadn't been playing on the Monday, I would have had to have gone elsewhere to watch my game. And I think with Sweden, where I saw Häcken, as you just mentioned, I was kind of trying to watch some of the underdog teams in Europe rather than go to the big names. And Häcken are kind of an unfashionable industrial club, very much the sort of ugly sister of IFK Gothenburg, who are the big city team in Gothenburg. And I think they really appealed. And yeah, I kind of enjoyed the feeling in both places. And I think it benefited the trip really by going to Gothenburg and Bergen rather than Stockholm and Oslo.
A question from Alex on Twitter. He says, what are some of the specific cultural differences between watching football in the Nordic countries?
So I mean, mentioned the family atmosphere in Iceland. I think Sweden was the first country where I felt that this was kind of an atmosphere a bit like watching English football. I saw Häcken play Hammarby, actually, and Hammarby got a massive away support, and the atmosphere there felt quite similar to an English game. I guess the other cultural differences of the first five countries, Sweden was the only one where you were allowed to drink beer on the terraces, which was quite interesting. But because of Swedish law, it's only relatively low alcohol. I think 3.5% is the limit there. And as for some of the similarities, I think one thing I noticed in the early countries was that there was a lot of rock and metal music being played before games. And I'm a big fan of the genres as well. So I was enjoying hearing the likes of Queen and Iron Maiden before watching my top division games in those countries.
Absolutely. Although it does sound like an interesting contrast that you say on the one hand, it was a kind of a family atmosphere. And then on the other hand, that they were playing Iron Maiden before the games. That's not necessarily music I'd associate with a family atmosphere.
Yeah, not at all. But they're some of the idiosyncrasies of football culture that I was exploring during my trip. And yeah, some of the most entertaining moments, as you suggest.
Looking back on those first five countries, what was your best footballing experience?
Oh, my best footballing experience. I think it was probably watching Bran win 5-0, because up until then I'd actually seen 4 away wins in a row. And I was beginning to think I had a massive curse on the home team. So it was such a relief. I mean, Bran were the heavy favourites to win that game against Starbeck. It was such a relief to see a home team win, the home crowd be really happy. And and also to see, it was attendance was, I think, about 10,000. So it was kind of like my first really, really big game. So, yeah, I think that was probably my favourite experience. I met some good people there in Bergen as well who appear throughout the chapter, and indeed I'm still in touch with a few of them over social media even now.
After your trip to Norway, you returned to London, didn't you? Even though Sweden is obviously a neighbouring country. Was returning to England something that you did often to save on costs, or what was the thinking behind that?
Yeah, I mean, you really don't want to spend a couple of weeks in Norway waiting for your Swedish game. Is far cheaper, particularly with budget flights, to just fly back to London. So I did it in kind of natural gaps in the fixture list. So for instance, even the San Marino League is cancelled when there are international fixtures. So, you know, whenever there was an international break, it was, you know, there'd be about 10 days when it was natural for me to travel back to the UK. But I also built in a couple of periods in August and December when I had longer in the UK, and that was primarily because I needed a rest from the road, but it was also because of quite a lot of seasons either hadn't got going in August or were taking a winter break in December, and there wasn't really much point spending time away from home if there was no football to watch.
Last question for this pod then, Matt. And when we first approached you about the interview, you said that you might have some extra tidbits for us that, you know, didn't make it into the book. Any stories from the first five countries that you additionally want to share with the listeners that didn't make the cut?
Yeah, maybe it's a little bit of a regret, actually, because I had to balance watching the football with recording it and also making sure I got enough rest for future travel. So actually, after the Norway game and the Sweden game, some of the local fans wanted me to go out and celebrate with them. But on both occasions, I said, well, you know, I've been out drinking beforehand. I'd spent a lot of time with the fans. I decided to take it easy and not go out with them. But I think in retrospect, I think I probably would have enjoyed at least one of those nights out with the Norwegians and the Swedes.
All right. Well, I've thoroughly enjoyed listening to your tales from your first five countries. I'm very much looking forward to hearing some more as well. Matt, thanks very much for joining us on the Sweeper Pod, and we can't wait to hear some more.
Thanks very much for having me.
If you've enjoyed this episode and you want to find out more about Matt's travels across the continent, then get yourself a copy of Europe United. It's available in hardback and paperback from all good bookshops and as an ebook as well. And you can also follow Matt on Twitter at 55 Football Nations. The football is without the two O's, so FTBALL, 55 Football Nations.
This has been The Sweeper, the monthly pan-European football podcast. It's recorded and produced in Vienna, Austria by TOB Sports Media, and it's brought to you by FOTMOB. Special thanks go to the Gentlemen Creatives in Vienna for their incredible Sweeper graphics. You can find their creative design agency at thegentlemancreatives.com.